morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. So on Friday, Chicago police shot and killed a man in the South Shore neighborhood. The man had a holstered gun and he was running away. Police say that he was grabbing for his gun before he was shot, and the body cam video that they released seems to bear that out. A few days before, a Park police officer in Minnesota pulled a gun on four black teens whom he already had handcuffed. It turns out someone called in that the teens had weapons. They did not. And of course, we have talked a couple of times in the last week about Milwaukee's $3.4 million settlement regarding stop and frisk policing, which some people see as racial profiling, actually including a federal judge in New York. I want to talk about good policing. I just moved to Madison, and maybe I'm naive, but I actually see police officers inquiring how homeless people are doing and being courteous to people of all ethnic origins who are walking by. I even remember covering the Act 10 protest in 2011 when I was in Chicago, and the police were some of the nicest people we ran into. So we're talking to Madison's police chief to find out what the secret sauce is on community policing. We're also taking your calls on this, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Has all the news of police shootings in recent years made you more skeptical of police, or do you think it's just more sensationalized than before? What kind of role do you think police should play in their communities? Chief Mike Koval is the chief of Madison Police. Welcome to the program, sir.
Well, thank you, and good morning.
Good morning. So so let's talk about this shooting in Chicago. It was really interesting to see. What I saw on the police cam was that the police reached out for him. There were like five or six people that were reaching out for him that were trying to grab him. He pulled away from them. And that's when they saw his gun, and he started to run away, and that's when he was shot. I don't know if he was trying to pull for his gun or not, but could the police on the ground there have handled that in a different way so that they could have grabbed him and subdued him before this even escalated?
Well, again, I guess that gets to not knowing all the facts
juncture,
and we want to be careful to suspend judgment until we have all those. But I do think that officers now more than ever, in light of the heightened scrutiny and the acknowledgement that a lot of these encounters could be prevented or de-escalated in some context, if you create time, if you create space, if you look for cover, all of those various things are being trained uniformly across the country in order to avoid sort of having to deal with the lethality of the moment. Again, we'll have to ultimately see what all the facts reflect on that, but relative to the more generic or open-ended question, are police being increasingly trained in de-escalation and avoiding lethal force? That is emphatically yes.
Okay, so what has your department done to train in de-escalation?
Well, I think one of the things is that you do an awful lot more of professional communication techniques. You do a lot of crisis intervention. You look at what are the sort of diagnostics of how the person is presenting, so you have a sense of what their capabilities are or what they're opining. And I think the fact of the matter is that you don't blindly go in unless, of course, it's the most exigent of circumstances. You wait for backup. You aren't as compulsive or impulsive about your response until such time as you can make a more measured response. Sometimes the situation is so dynamic it prevents that. But I think we're being more deliberative, more intentional. And I also think that it really starts with what's your point of emphasis from the types of people you hire and the points of emphasis that you train in, not only at the pre-service level, but as part of an officer's continuing adult education, as it would be.
Points of emphasis brings me to what is policing supposed to be? I mean, is it a lock up criminals, find people who are breaking the law and lock them up, or is it build trust within the community to prevent that?
Well, clearly it's the latter, and I think we have been duped as a profession to some extent. We have not strenuously objected at times when we probably could have or should have, in the sense that we have been characterized as, you know, only a crime-fighting model. And in that sense, that is a legal fiction in the sense that if we quantify how much of an officer's day is spent to literally enforcing laws or law enforcement, at best, it's probably about 25% of their work duties. And the reality is that we're much more inclined to be social workers, diagnosticians, mental health interveners, collaborators, referrals, civil dispute mediators. There are so many things that go to quality of life, go to the issues of AODA, goes to the issues of mental illness. Those, we find, tend to be the drivers of what really consumes our officers' time and resources, and that requires someone who understands that our job is much more that of social worker, and we have been statutorily provided with a gun and a badge in those limited instances where it might become necessary. But oftentimes, I think we were only too happy to enjoy sort of that machismo reputation as depicted in movies and in folklore, and that did us a disservice, I think, in the long analysis.
I'm interested in your analysis of police officers as social worker, especially around people with mental illness. Are you trying to train officers to deal with this, or is the time better spent getting better social workers and getting more funding so that police officers don't have to deal with this?
Well, again, in a best-case scenario, those who have literally that subject matter expertise and deal with mental health issues day in and day out, that is the best practice by all means. But the fact of the matter is we don't have that capacity right now. Seldom do you find social workers or some sort of contingency deployment where 24/7, if it's 2 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and someone has locked themselves into their bathroom and they're cutting their wrists with their knife. We don't want to expose social workers to the potential of what that is, nor do they want to be exposed to that. So I think then that the next best model is what we've employed, in that we give our officers a heavy influx of mental health diagnostics, referral, and collaboration. We have 3 social worker clinicians that are embedded with the City of Madison Police Department. We'll have 3. We have 2, and we're ready to hire our 3rd. And they work hand in glove with our officers, doing follow-up, doing preemption, doing problem-solving, seeing people who have fallen between the cracks. So we have never claimed to be by any means experts, but I do think that we can continue to train our officers into being more capable diagnosticians of what they see as manifestations of behavior, and hopefully avert those people from getting involved in the criminal justice system when they should actually be getting help or treatment or an intervention.
We are talking about community policing and the changes that police forces have been going through with Madison Police Chief Mike Koval. We also are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. Dwayne from Hayward, welcome to the program.
Good morning. As a retired police officer of 33 years and as a police instructor, what you see in this community policing, that a lot of people jump to conclusions when they watch these videos or body cam videos before they actually have the facts. If you look at this particular video and you stop action at frame by frame, you see that he was actually trying to draw his gun when he broke away from the police officers. He was running away. He actually did draw his gun. He was turning towards the police with that weapon when he was fatally shot. He was not shot in the back. He was not shot running away. He was shot when he turned towards the police and placed them in danger.
Yeah, it does seem to show him reaching for the gun. I did not see it pull it out. But this is kind of a more of a cut and dried thing. Chief Koval, my question again, though, is, when officers face a situation like that, is there a way to de-escalate before it gets to the point where somebody might draw their gun?
Well, some of the situations are clearly unavoidable, unfortunately, and I want to thank the caller for his 33 years of service.
Yes.
That's wonderful. I think that, as you probably understand, ultimately, when we look at criminal culpability or to see if the officer was at fault, the courts will apply the Supreme Court standard from a case known as Graham versus Connor. And in that standard, the court will say that we have to look at these highly dynamic, rapidly evolving situations under a lens of, did the officer act with objective reasonableness based on the totality of the circumstances as they were presented and in light of the officer's training and experience? And that is, and I think, an appropriate standard, because otherwise it would be very difficult to attract people to our line of work if
right.
everything were ultimately reduced to the fact that it's a Monday morning quarterback situation where others who have the luxury of time and analysis of a frame-by-frame analysis, as the caller pointed out, that you can then have the luxury of saying, well, the officer was preemptive on that one, should not.
We are talking to Madison Police Chief Mike Koval about community policing, what has worked and what has not worked. We'll be back in a moment. It's The Morning Show. We're talking about community policing with Madison Chief, Police Chief Mike Koval, and we're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. You can also email us at more ideas at WPR.org. Chief Koval, one of the reasons I wanted to do this is because we've been talking a lot about Milwaukee and a $3.4 million settlement about community policing. We've gotten a lot of complaints. I just did a show on Milwaukee and how great Milwaukee is. And people called in and said, yeah, it's great, except for the police. And my experience here in Madison is that police officers are pretty nice and pretty attentive, even to homeless people, even to people who are not necessarily, you know, the wealthy people. Is this something that has changed over the years? Did you need to change that culture, or has that always just been part of Madison nice?
I think that's more Madison nice. I'd like to take a bow for some of that, but I think that because we're very intentional about how we market our brand and our culture, the people that we select, I just hired a class of 37. The average age is 29, so a lot of them are on second or third different career avocations. A lot of them have been intrepid travelers, no second languages. And we have every major academically under the sun that could possibly be represented. It literally, everything from anthropology to zoology. And then you have the guys like me with a journalism degree, so I'm still in a state of 12-step recovery,
wow,
too.
Wow, wow.
But when you
I'm so sorry.
Have that much diversity in your workplace, I think then that creates an environment of caring and guardianship that is impressed upon people from the time they're recruited to the time that they go through the training. We obviously go to great pains. The state requires a 720-hour curriculum. Ours is closer to 900, in which we can do a lot more of the sort of what I call cultural humility opportunities, where we bring in demographics from the city, whether it be cultural, whether it be deprived, whether it be consumer panels of people with mental illness. And I think that owing to that exposure, repeatedly so, and the mindset people bring to our workplace, makes for a great karma in terms of approachability and taking the time and making the effort to look for what I call always striving for BPR, best possible resolution. I challenge my officers. I say, we know that we always probably have that default of arrest or a ticket, but that shouldn't be our first default in a lot of these behaviors that have been presented. I urge them to think out of the box with a lens towards restorative justice and humanity and find options above and beyond those traditional responses by law enforcement. And in that sense, I think that these folks have done a wonderful job of challenging themselves to stretch those resources to the limit and try to be more resourceful in the field. And I'm glad that that's generally reflected in a more respectful encounter.
So getting to that, I do want to bring up the shooting of Tony Robinson in 2015. Mm-hmm. Tony Robinson was a 19-year-old. He was shot by police officer Matt Kenny, mm-hmm. and that was ruled lawful use. In fact, witnesses said that he was tweaking out, that's a quote, on mushrooms in front of his cars and intimidating bystanders. But there was also a settlement there with his family, a $3.3 million settlement, and it kind of made a rift between police officers and the African-American community. Have you been able to heal that rift a little bit?
Well, I think I'd be naive to say that we have since completely reconciled and have moved forward. I think that when you invest as much as you try to in the community and you pride yourself on an engagement that doesn't result in those kinds of outcomes, that invariably there is going to be a percentage of those individuals who now mistrust the police, and I understand that rationale, because we are not immune from the focal points and the narratives that are played out throughout the country, starting with Ferguson and beyond. I mean, today, 4 years later, we're still seeing vestiges of the Eric Garner that all of us witnessed in the chokehold incident. So we suffered both from that national malady or malaise that we see played out all too often, and we don't have clean hands either, in that we have to own what we own. And I'm constantly saying that we have to try to slow, and over time, it's not going to happen overnight. Each officer is challenged one call, one contact at a time, as if it were the only call you were going to be encountering for the next 8 hours, and make that an effective relational encounter where we can change that narrative, albeit one call at a time.
So when you see things like Eric Garner, who was killed in New York on Staten Island in a chokehold, his last words were, "I can't breathe," which then became a rallying cry. When you see something like that, do you cringe?
Yes. Okay. I don't know how you can't. And even with the quote, the fact that we were exonerated of any criminal culpability in Tony Robinson, I cringe whenever a member of our community is killed. That's nothing that anybody takes lightly. And of course, we still grieve and mourn the loss of any kind of life. Our code of conduct places an emphasis on the sanctity of life. So it's counterintuitive for an officer to want to use deadly force. But to your point, you're right in the sense that one of the things that I find interesting about the Eric Garner thing, and up until perhaps the most recent developments, is that body-worn cameras have been used as a salvo to everything, in the sense that, well, they guarantee instantaneous transparency as well as accountability.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with Eric Garner, we all see how many hits on YouTube. I mean, that thing has plenty and plenty of transparency. But if you ask those locals who live in that community, what about the accountability? Literally, it's 4 years later. They have yet to hear from the Department of Justice. The family was given a wrongful death settlement, of course, which assuages some of their own loss. But in terms of the community, I don't know that those officers have been disciplined to date. And so they would argue that there wasn't accountability. So sometimes even the technological fixes of what a body-worn camera represents, it might be a short-term solution. But at the end of the day, you have to hope that you have authentic relationships of trust being built in your community, because no technology is going to cure that overnight.
We are talking about community policing, and we are taking your calls. Paul from Milwaukee, welcome to the program, Paul.
Hi there. Yeah, I just want to comment on building trust in the communities and how the war on drugs has undermined that, especially the war on weed. I mean, we see pharmaceutical executives sitting on yachts, and I believe they're responsible or mostly responsible for one of the biggest opioid epidemics in history, yet we are arresting more often than not African-Americans in urban areas which just decimates their communities. And I believe that that really undermines trust in the police, especially from those urban communities.
Thank you very much, Paul. Chief Koval, things, nonviolent crimes such as, carrying an ounce of pot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and again, I like, first of all, how your caller, Paul, opened. I think this, the metaphorical use of terms, war on drugs, mm-hmm. war on crime, has completely sort of sent us into a tailspin, again, in terms of that public imagery of officers as warriors, officers as vigilante crime fighters. I would much prefer looking at us as guardians to the community, because to me that is more representative of our totality of what we're aiming to do. But Madison has decriminalized casual possession of marijuana for the better part of now 35 years plus since I started out as a police officer. So for us, it's literally the fine for casual possession of marijuana is less than an open can of Coors Light walking down the street. So I agree with the caller in that we have to have some adult conversations universally as we look to all the states around us who are looking at decriminalizing marijuana, using it for medicinal purposes. Some have gone to outright decriminalizing to the point of regulating and taxing it and using that funding for other things like schools or treatment modalities. I agree that we should not be warehousing people for those sort of crimes of that stature. As a matter of fact, we are currently involved in a huge initiative called the MARI Initiative, Madison Addiction Recovery Initiative, where we're attempting to give people options when we encounter them as drug overdoses, at heroin episodes, where within a couple of days they can choose to opt into treatment for 6 months, or they can go through the conventional doors of the criminal justice system. So we're trying to do our part to be a diversionary force, understanding that a lot of addictions are in fact medically related and they shouldn't be criminalized.
Okay, Chief, we've got a couple more calls we'd like to take. Mike from Twin Lakes, but he's driving now, I'm told. Mike, welcome to the program.
I've got a Bluetooth on.
Okay, good.
The thing I'd like to say is I'm tired of everybody busting the cops' chops. They have to be educated. They have to be this. When are we going to educate the public? In every case you bring up, whether it was choking or shooting, if that person had just followed the orders of the police officer, put their hands up, or got on the ground, it's a matter of respect. The kids nowadays don't respect their parents, they don't respect their teachers, and they definitely don't respect a police officer. But if they follow those rules, then if they had a beef, they take it to court. But in every case, they refuse to do what they were ordered. That's where we have to educate the public to start showing respect again. And God bless all these police officers out here busting their butts to keep us safe. That's all.
Thank you very much for that, Mike. We're going to go to Mary in Madison. We got to get in these phone calls before the end of the hour. Mary, welcome to the program.
Hello. Yes, I want to first thank Chief Koval for finding resources towards more community policing. However, I do want to address the previous callers talking about educating the public and the incident that happened in Chicago on Friday. My question is, how come, why is it that whenever there's a black man with a gun, he never comes out alive, but when there's a mass shooting, and 9 out of 10 times, that individual is a white male with multiple guns, and they always come out alive? So my question is this still because police are more fearful of black men than they do with white men? I'm just very confused, and I need clarification.
Okay, so Chief, we have like less than a minute left, but from what I see, isn't that just two different units dealing with those two different situations?
Yeah, and I agree with the caller that the profile of a lot of these active shooters tend to be white males, albeit lone wolves, and some take their own lives, some do surrender to the authorities, as we've seen. But I think to the caller's larger issue, if I think I've assumed the right thing.
In 10 seconds.
Is we're talking about unconscious biases that we all have. We've trained on this for the past 10 years. We were first inspired by the works of Patricia Devine at the University of Wisconsin. And we embrace that as a phenomena that if we are more in tune with what those implicit biases may be. If everyone is supervisors and line officers and everyone, then we could perhaps identify those before they become actionable. And I think unconscious bias is something that more and more time and effort has to be spent in talking about.
Chief Koval, thank you very much for joining us today. You're listening to The Morning Show.